Marilyn Monroe, a story in three parts. This is part two, Becoming an Icon. Marilyn Monroe stated, "In Hollywood, a girl's virtue is much less important than her hairdo. You're judged by how you look, not by what you are. Hollywood's a place where they'll pay you $1,000 for a kiss and 50 cents for your soul. I know, because I turned down the first offer often enough and held out for the 50. We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows. On October 4th, 1952, Marilyn and Bob Slatzer shared an evening filled with champagne and heartfelt conversation before impulsively deciding to take a drive to Mexico's Rosarita Beach. During their night out, the couple's escapades led them to the Foreign Club in Tijuana, where they ran into an old friend named Kid Chisel. This chance encounter led to an unexpected plan. Let's get married! With Kid Chisel as their witness, the couple found a willing lawyer to officiate the ceremony. Marilyn, prior to the wedding, visited a local Mexican church to offer a prayer. When they arrived at the lawyer's office, the necessary documents were filled out, and they were officially wed. However, shortly thereafter, Marilyn experienced a change of heart. She decided that she did not want to remain married to Bob Slatzer. So together, they journeyed back to Mexico, where they convinced the same lawyer who had married them to destroy the yet unprocessed marriage certificate, the sole tangible evidence of their very brief union. Ultimately, Marilyn's marriage to Bob Slatzer lasted for a mere 3 days, making it one of the most fleeting chapters in her tumultuous love life. In December of 1953, Marilyn Monroe's status as a preeminent sex symbol was irrefutably confirmed when Hugh Hefner featured her on the cover and as the centerfold in the inaugural issue of Playboy, despite her lack of consent for the publication. The cover image had been taken during the Miss America pageant parade in 1952, and the centerfold was featuring one of her 1949 nude photographs, catapulting her to new heights of fame. Returning to work in 1953 with unparalleled vigor, Marilyn garnered critical acclaim for her roles in films such as Monkey Business, alongside Cary Grant, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes with Jane Russell, and How to Marry a Millionaire with Betty Grable and Lauren Bacall. To further solidify her stardom, Marilyn and Jane Russell pressed their hands and footprints in wet concrete outside of Grauman's Chinese Theater in June as part of the publicity campaign for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which later became one of the year's biggest box office hits. Critics, including Crowther of the New York Times and William Brogdon of Variety, praised her performances, particularly highlighting her rendition of Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. The year, 1954, marked a turning point in Marilyn's life, but not necessarily for the better. She faced suspension from the studio after failing to appear for the shooting of The Girl in the Pink Tights, a project she considered unsuitable for her career, making headlines for all the wrong reasons. To counter this negative publicity, Marilyn took swift action. Joe DiMaggio, the legendary Yankees baseball player who had courted Marilyn for nearly a year, was determined to marry her. Just 2 weeks after her suspension, on January 14, 1954, they were wed in a simple ceremony in San Francisco, California, with only a handful of attendees. On January 29, 1954, 15 days later, the couple flew to Japan, combining a honeymoon with DiMaggio's commitment to his former San Francisco Seals coach, Lefty O'Doul, to help train Japanese baseball teams. However, the marital bliss was short-lived. Joe's jealousy, which extended to both men and women, cast a shadow over the relationship right from the beginning. Friends and colleagues of Marilyn attested to Joe's overt dominance, harsh criticism, and occasional violence throughout their union. Yet they both maintained that their love for each other endured. During their time in Japan, Marilyn joined Jean O'Doul, Lefty's wife, for a USO show in Korea, where she performed for over 60,000 U.S. Marines. Marilyn had a broken thumb, which was attributed to Joe DiMaggio's anger over her decision to entertain the troops. This marked the onset of physical abuse, and it would not be the last time. Marilyn was awarded PhotoPlay's Most Popular Female Star prize upon returning to the U.S. In March, she settled with Fox, securing a new contract, a $100,000 bonus, and a starring role in the film adaptation of the Broadway hit The 7-Year Itch. As filming began in September of 1954, Marilyn Monroe became iconic for the scene in which she stood on a subway grate on Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, her white dress billowing from the rushing subway air. However, rumors circulated that Joe was infuriated by the spectacle and allegedly beat her later that evening for embarrassing him. Marilyn's breaking point came in October 1954, just 9 months into their marriage, when she announced her decision to divorce Joe. They appeared in court for a divorce hearing on October 27th, with Marilyn citing mental cruelty as the grounds for divorce. Despite the divorce being granted, Joe refused to let go of his feelings for Marilyn, leading to a series of troubling events. Following the divorce, Joe's obsessive jealousy grew more intense. He could not bear the thought of Marilyn with anyone else. One fateful night, his jealousy spiraled out of control, resulting in a scandalous incident and a lawsuit. In November 1954, Joe DiMaggio, accompanied by his new friend and a man you may have heard of named Frank Sinatra, were allegedly involved in a break-in at Florence Cott's home. While Florence was asleep in her bed, two intruders entered her apartment and took photographs of her. This awoke her, and she began screaming in terror. Eventually, it was revealed that the intruders were Joe DiMaggio and Frank Sinatra, who had wanted to catch Marilyn Monroe with another lover, but they had mistakenly entered the wrong apartment. Marilyn was dining with friends in a different part of the building at the time. The mishap, dubbed the wrong door raid, led to charges of illegal entry and destruction of private property. Due to the darkness and confusion, the identities of the intruders remained uncertain, leading to the eventual dismissal of the case. Nevertheless, Florence Cott's sued both men, resulting in an out-of-court settlement. This incident opened Marilyn's eyes to the lengths to which her ex-husband would go to reclaim her. Despite their lingering affection for each other, she knew their relationship was beyond repair. Amid these tumultuous events, Marilyn also began to secretly set her sights on someone new. From late 1954 to February of 1956, Marilyn Monroe purposefully retreated from the relentless public eye, seeking refuge from the tumultuous whirlwind of her life in California. She briefly resided with friends in Connecticut and later settled into an apartment in New York City, This hiatus offered her the invaluable opportunity to engage in introspection and begin a personal reinvention. During this self-imposed sabbatical and her studio-enforced suspension, Marilyn joined forces with her friend Milton Green to establish Marilyn Monroe Productions, an endeavor that would later be hailed as instrumental in challenging the dominance of the Hollywood studio system. This pivotal decision emerged from Marilyn's refusal to be typecast in stereotypical dumb blonde roles. She aspired to seize control of her own career, gravitating towards more profound and demanding roles. Furthermore, Marilyn asserted that her contractual obligations with Fox had been unmet, particularly concerning their promised bonus. This assertion initiated an extended legal battle with the studio, starting in January of 1955. The press, however, largely ridiculed Marilyn Monroe during this period. Her persona became fodder for parody, as evidenced in the Broadway play Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, where her doppelganger, Jane Mansfield, portrayed a dim-witted actress who established her own production company. If you're unfamiliar with Jane Mansfield, you may know her daughter, Law & Order SVU goddess Mariska Hargitay. Anyway, throughout this hiatus, Marilyn maintained her relationship with Joe DiMaggio, despite their ongoing divorce proceedings. She also found herself romantically involved with the actor Marlon Brando and playwright Arthur Miller. Her initial introduction to Arthur Miller had come in the early 1950s, courtesy of Ilya Kazan. Their affair gained momentum following the finalization of her divorce in October of 55, coinciding with the famous playwright's separation from his wife as well. The film studio advised Marilyn to sever ties with Arthur Miller, as he was under FBI investigation for alleged communist affiliations and had been summoned by the House Committee for Un-American Activities. However, Marilyn staunchly refused. This defiance prompted the FBI to open a file on her as well. As the intensity of her relationship with playwright Arthur Miller grew, they wed on June 29, 1956. Following their nuptials, Marilyn and Arthur spent their initial post-marriage weeks in England. Yet their marital bliss proved to be fleeting, as they frequently argued. At one point, Arthur told Marilyn that she reminded him of his ex-wife, whom he vehemently despised. Nevertheless, fame continued to be an unwavering companion to Marilyn. She reconciled with 20th Century Fox, securing a lucrative deal worth $400,000 for four films. This agreement granted her unprecedented artistic autonomy, allowing her to select her own projects, directors, and cinematographers. Additionally, she retained the freedom to participate in one film produced by Marilyn Monroe Productions for every completed Fox film. Over the following years, she starred in a string of blockbuster hits, including Some Like It Hot and The Misfits. Her collaboration with Marilyn Monroe Productions yielded notable films like Bus Stop and The Prince and the Showgirl. In total, between 1956 and the end of 1960, Marilyn graced the silver screen in five memorable movies. Marilyn Monroe's exceptional performance in the movie Some Like It Hot earned her Golden Globe for Best Actress, and Variety acclaimed her as the comedienne possessing an irresistible blend of sex appeal and impeccable timing. Some Like It Hot also garnered accolades in numerous polls conducted by esteemed institutions such as the BBC and the American Film Institute, earning recognition as one of the greatest films ever made. In 1960, Marilyn's life took a distressing turn as she began grappling with a series of nervous breakdowns. She endured several heart-wrenching failed pregnancies and she watched as her third marriage crumbled right before her very eyes. These personal upheavals mirrored the challenges that plagued her professional life, as she struggled to cope with mounting pressure and responsibilities. Her reputation as a reliable actress began to wane as she developed a notorious habit of arriving late, or in some cases, failing to show up at all for film shoots. The breaking point came on November 11, 1960, when Marilyn and Arthur Miller publicly announced their impending divorce, marking the end of a 4.5-year marriage. As her personal life unraveled, Marilyn descended into a tumultuous period marked by intermittent stays in psychiatric clinics to address her borderline personality disorder. Her ever-growing reliance on barbiturates and alcohol exacerbated her emotional pain and insomnia. During this chaotic period, Marilyn forged a professional relationship with a new psychiatrist, Dr. Ralph Greenson, characterized by an unusual dependency and some unconventional medical practices. Simultaneously, she became embroiled in a short-lived but highly publicized affair with Frank Sinatra. She also cultivated friendships with influential individuals, including Peter Lawford, Pat Kennedy, and Pat Newcomb, who became her closest friend and confidant. Amidst this backdrop, Marilyn entered into a complex web of relationships with John F. Kennedy and his little brother, Bobby Kennedy, powerful political figures with whom she was rumored to have had simultaneous affairs. While her heart appeared to belong to John, the elder of the Kennedy brothers, her liaisons with both siblings remained discreet. The secrecy surrounding these affairs drew the attention of the FBI, who had already opened a file on her. In 1962, Marilyn moved into a new home in Brentwood, California. This home was in proximity to the Lawford residence and her psychiatrist, Dr. Greenson. Despite intensive therapy, her depression and anxiety worsened, leading to several accidental overdoses. Dr. Greenson became a central figure in her life, and he hired a live-in companion, Eunice Murray, to care for Marilyn. Observers noted the unusual close involvement of Miss Murray and Dr. Greenson in Marilyn's daily life, leading to speculation about their possible motives. Marilyn's turbulent relationship with Joe DiMaggio continued even after her divorce from Arthur Miller, marked by his overbearing jealousy and occasional physical altercations. Despite these challenges, she maintained a friendship with Joe, who remained deeply devoted to her. Aside from Joe DiMaggio and Arthur Miller, Marilyn's relationships with John and Bobby Kennedy were also coming to a head. Marilyn was often spotted in the company of one of these two powerful brothers during social affairs. Many people believed that Bobby had truly fallen in love with the glamorous icon, but she did not reciprocate Bobby's feelings. But she did care for him deeply, and she maintained a sexual relationship with him. Marilyn's heart belonged to John F. Kennedy, who would pay her visits at her own home, or he would see her while at the Lawfords' home, where many said they conducted their secret love affair. It was claimed by Peter Lawford's wife, Pat Kennedy, that Marilyn and the President of the United States often made love in one of the bathrooms of the Lawford home. In fact, former Kennedy advisor Peter Summers claimed that he had once encountered the pair as they exited one of these bathrooms. Marilyn was wearing nothing but a towel, and Summers stated she'd clearly been in there, in the shower with him. It was obvious, but neither of them seemed worried about it. John Kennedy spoke with Marilyn so frequently during the beginning to mid-1962 that he gave her a private number so she could reach him directly through the Justice Department. As Marilyn became increasingly reclusive, her relationships with influential men in Hollywood and Washington, D.C. raised eyebrows. Her involvement with the Kennedys particularly President John F. Kennedy, became a subject of intense scrutiny. Rumors of their sexual liaisons swirled, and Marilyn's emotional investment in John fueled her beliefs that he might, someday, divorce Jackie Kennedy to marry her, which would make her Marilyn Monroe, the First Lady of the United States of America. In April 1962, Marilyn started work on her film, Something's Got to Give, signaling her potential return to professional success. The following month, on May 19th, Marilyn delivered her famously seductive rendition of Happy Birthday to President John F. Kennedy at Madison Square Garden.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Marilyn garnered significant attention for her choice of attire, a form-fitting beige dress adorned with sparkling rhinestones, creating the illusion of nudity, despite the president's lighthearted response thanking Marilyn for singing to him in such a sweet and wholesome way. The rumors surrounding their connection escalated. By the summer of 1962, Marilyn had become a national security concern due to her alleged relationship with the Kennedys. In the interest of preserving their reputations and avoiding a scandal, Marilyn was instructed to sever all ties with the brothers, leaving her emotionally shattered. Marilyn then began work on a pivotal scene for Something's Got to Give, wherein she swam completely nude in a pristine swimming pool. In a bold move to generate pre-release buzz, the press was granted access to capture these iconic moments. These images would later be featured in Life magazine. This groundbreaking event marked the first instance of a major star posing nude at the peak of their career. However, a series of setbacks quickly unfolded. Marilyn experienced another bout of illness, prompting concerns at Fox about the film's production delays. With the studio already grappling with escalating costs for the movie Cleopatra, starring Elizabeth Taylor, they made a tough decision. On June 7th, Fox terminated Marilyn Monroe's contract and filed a lawsuit against her, seeking $750,000 in damages. Lee Remick was chosen as her replacement, but when Dean Martin insisted on working only with Marilyn Monroe, Fox also sued him, leading to the project being shut down by the studio. Fox pinned the blame for the film's derailment on Marilyn, even resorting to unfavorable publicity campaigns, including allegations of her mental instability. However, Fox quickly realized the magnitude of their mistake and reopened negotiations with Marilyn later in June. An agreement was eventually reached, outlining a new contract that included the continuation of Something's Got to Give, a starring role in the dark comedy What a Way to Go, and her intention to lead a biopic about Jean Harlow, the 30s blonde bombshell who tragically died at just 26 years old of kidney failure. In an effort to restore her public image, Marilyn engaged in various promotional endeavors, including interviews for prestigious publications such as Life and Cosmopolitan, as well as her first ever photo session with Vogue. During this collaboration with photographer Bert Stern, conducted over 3 days, Marilyn participated in 2 series of photographs, a conventional fashion editorial spread and a daring nude photo shoot. These images would be published posthumously under the title The Last Sitting, and they would become iconic photography. During this period of her life, Marilyn's mental state reportedly deteriorated significantly. She confided in close friends about her intention to reveal details about her relationships with the Kennedy brothers as a form of payback for the emotional pain she had endured during their involvement in her life. However, just before Marilyn's tragic death, her career and personal life appeared to be on an upswing. She was actively engaged in several promising film projects that had ignited her excitement and enthusiasm. In the days leading up to her passing, a significant event took place at Lake Tahoe. According to Donald Wolfe's reporting, Marilyn spent that weekend with Joe DiMaggio. The couple talked about plans of rekindling their romance and possibly remarrying. However, another perspective presented by biographer Donald Spado changes this narrative. Spado asserts that Frank Sinatra arranged the weekend at the Calneva Lodge at the behest of the Kennedys, who were concerned that Marilyn might divulge her relationship with the president to the press. This was a scenario they simply could not allow to take place. Wolfe adds that Joe DiMaggio's arrival at the Lake Tahoe Resort was somewhat unexpected, possibly at Marilyn's request. Furthermore, his research suggests the presence of notorious mobster Sam Giancana at this gathering. Giancana's purpose, as per Wolfe, was to ensure that Marilyn did not pose any threats to the Kennedys. According to Wolfe, Joe DiMaggio was deeply upset with Frank Sinatra and the Kennedys for orchestrating Marilyn's visit, allegedly plying her with drugs and possibly taking compromising photos of her, which could be used as leverage in case she intended to expose her connections with the Kennedy family. After this somewhat dubious weekend, where all the facts still seem to be in dispute, even 60 years later, Marilyn traveled home, back to Hollywood, back to her Brentwood home. And the following weekend, Marilyn Monroe, a living icon, would be found dead in that very Brentwood house. Her death was an apparent suicide, an overdose of sleeping pills. Intentional? Some think so. Some think it was an accident. And yet, there are still many others who do not believe that Marilyn died of either of those options. And so now, we are going to explore the many theories surrounding the death of Marilyn Monroe. I'm going to start by explaining what we know about Marilyn's final days here on Earth, starting on Friday, August 3rd, the Friday just before Marilyn died. On this day, Marilyn reached out to Ann Karger, a trusted and longtime confidant. During their conversation, Marilyn revealed her deep affection for John Kennedy, expressing her intentions to marry him. However, her tone was stained with a tinge of melancholy. Ann, in response, gently scolded Marilyn, trying to bring a dose of reality to her somewhat capricious desires. On this very same day, an interaction that would linger in the memories of several individuals occurred. Marilyn contacted Robert Slatzer, another close friend, revealing her futile attempts to connect with Robert Kennedy in Washington. Frustrated by her lack of success, Marilyn called actor Peter Lawford, who was the Kennedys' brother-in-law by marriage, and she asked him to contact the Kennedys for her. Amid a shroud of mystery and suspense, Robert Kennedy embarked on a journey to California that same day. Accompanied by his wife and four children, his usual charismatic smile seemed conspicuously absent. His handshakes, typically warm and engaging, felt rigid and lifeless to those who greeted him. As Friday, August 3rd unfolded, Marilyn's desperate attempts to reach out to Robert Kennedy became more apparent. press reports, and classified FBI documents revealed her persistent efforts to contact him at the hotel where he was expected to stay. Her messages, however, remained unanswered. But Marilyn's concerns were not solely confined to Robert Kennedy. During a rare moment of candor with columnist Sidney Skolsky, Marilyn had confided to him exclusively about her relationship with John Kennedy, and she hinted at her expectation of being in his company during an upcoming visit. Then at 6 a.m. on August 4th, 1962, Marilyn made a phone call that would send shivers down the spines of those who heard her. She reached out to her close friend, Jean Carmen, her voice trembling with nervous exhaustion. In a hushed tone, she recounted some disturbing phone calls she had received during the night from a mysterious caller. The chilling voice on the other end of the line said, "Leave Bobby alone." And then they called Marilyn a tramp before hanging up the phone. Marilyn's words were spoken in a tone of profound distress, and this left Jean deeply unsettled. Marilyn asked Jean to come to her aid, yearning for her presence and solace on this turbulent day. But fate had other plans. You see, it was Jean's birthday, and so she promised to see Marilyn on the following Sunday, unknowingly leaving her friend in a perilous and uncertain state. Inside Marilyn's home, she had two different phones. A pink one, its number accessible to everyday callers, and a white one, with a number she entrusted solely to her most intimate friends. Both phones came equipped with lengthy extension cords, affording Marilyn the freedom to wander all throughout her home as she engaged in conversations that often carried whispers of secrecy and intimacy. Across the sprawling city of Los Angeles, Sidney Skolsky, a regular fixture in Marilyn's life, made his customary weekend call to her on that particular day. However, the gravity of her recent revelations regarding the Kennedys had sparked concern in Sidney. He was determined to figure out what was really going on, and so he asked his daughter, Steffi, to assist him. Together, Sidney and his daughter, Steffi, listened over the phone as Marilyn spoke. Marilyn spoke in a hushed voice about an imminent rendezvous, a secret meeting slated for that very evening, hinting at a connection with one of the illustrious Kennedy brothers. The sun cast its morning rays over the quiet, unassuming day of Saturday, August 4th, 1962, a day that should have been just another page in the extraordinary life of Marilyn Monroe. As the clock neared 8 a.m., Eunice Murray, Marilyn's live-in assistant and housekeeper, arrived to commence her daily tasks within the confines of Marilyn's residence at 12305 Fifth Helena Drive. The world stirred, and Norman Jeffries, Marilyn's handyman and Eunice Murray's son-in-law, joined the tapestry of this domestic scene, and he began his work tiling the kitchen floor. Around 9 a.m., Marilyn was already up, sipping her grapefruit juice and sharing her early morning presence with Eunice. Marilyn casually mentioned that her agent, Pat Newcomb, had spent the night. Norman Jeffries, recounting the events of that day, recalled that Marilyn came into the kitchen, wrapped only in a bath towel. The pallor of her skin and the fatigue etched upon her features were impossible to ignore. Something seemed amiss, something deeper than mere fatigue. By 10 a.m., Larry Schiller paid a visit to Marilyn's home. Their discussion revolved around an upcoming photo shoot for Playboy magazine, featuring Marilyn in all of her nude splendor, a candid capture from the set of Something's Got to Give. Marilyn, in the midst of tending to her garden, greeted him. However, their conversation led them to reconsider the shoot. Marilyn had reservations about the photo shoot. She did not want to further cement her image as a mere sex symbol, She was more than sex. The hours danced away, and between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m., a new addition arrived at Marilyn's sanctuary, a bedside table, the emblem of domesticity. Marilyn, ever the hostess of her own life, wrote a check to the delivery man. After this came another delivery, citrus trees, Marilyn's latest horticultural indulgence, and they found their place within the landscape of her home. Around noon, Pat Newcomb roused from her slumber, and Eunice Murray, with her naturing capacity, offered Pat breakfast. The air between Pat and Marilyn, however, felt contentious, the result of an argument that had taken place earlier. In truth, the discord stemmed from Pat's relationship to the Kennedys, a reality that had begun to fracture the bonds of their tight friendship. Pat intended to spend the afternoon poolside with Marilyn, and then later join Peter Lawford and his wife, Pat Kennedy Lawford, for an evening meal. The layers of the day peeled back, revealing a complex mosaic of emotions and interactions in the life of the icon Marilyn Monroe. Later that afternoon, Marilyn received a visit from Agnes Flanagan, one of her longtime friends and hairdressers. As Agnes was at the house, another delivery man arrived bearing a package. Marilyn eagerly unwrapped it and emerged from the house clutching a stuffed toy tiger. Her face bore the weight of profound sadness. As Agnes would later recall, describing her as apparently terribly, terribly depressed. In the absence of words to console her anguished friend, Agnes eventually left. Photographs captured the scene at the rear of Marilyn's house the following day, revealing the presence of not one, but two abandoned plush animals near the pool, one of which was possibly a tiger. Did a devastating message accompany the toy animal, or was the tiger itself a cryptic message? I want you to keep this in the back of your mind. A real-life stuffed tiger held a place of prominence in Robert Kennedy's office at the Justice Department in Washington. Coincidence? What do you think? Marilyn appeared to be spiraling out of control. Eunice Murray was at Marilyn's home most of the day, and Dr. Greenson came to Marilyn's home after lunch. Donald Wolfe quotes Eunice Murray as saying that she called Greenson after Marilyn asked her if there was any oxygen around. She stated that this was an odd request and something Marilyn had never asked for before. Between 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. on August 4, 1962, Norman Jeffries was in the process of loading his work tools into his truck when he received startling news from Eunice Murray. She informed him that she had just been fired by Marilyn, with the expectation that she would vacate the premises by the day's end. Norman offered to help Eunice with packing her belongings, but he also wondered if he, too, would face termination. Meanwhile, Marilyn had retreated to her bedroom. By 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., mechanic Henry D'Antonio and his wife arrived, delivering Eunice's recently repaired car. Eunice welcomed them into the kitchen, and she told them that Marilyn was resting in her room. Most of the afternoon, Marilyn spent with Dr. Ralph Greenson, her psychiatrist, except for a time in mid-afternoon when Marilyn went out for a car ride with Eunice driving. There was a noticeable difference in Marilyn's condition during the afternoon. While she had been alert during the morning, she appeared to be in an almost drugged state during the afternoon. Her internist, Dr. Hyman Engelberg, had just refilled her Nembutal prescription the previous day, and it was possible that Marilyn had taken one or more of these capsules. Dr. Greenson had been trying to break Marilyn's Nembutal habit and switch her to chloral hydrate as a sleep aid. However, Marilyn had various ways to obtain her preferred drug, and she had plenty of them around her residence. Between 4:30 and 5:30 p.m. on August 4th, Marilyn engaged in a therapy session with Dr. Greenson. It is reported that during this session, Dr. Greenson advised Marilyn to have a Coca-Cola and go on a walk down the beach. You gotta love 60s doctors. Just have a Coca-Cola. Anyway, Dr. Greenson spent some time with Marilyn alone, and then later in the afternoon, he asked Pat to leave for a while because Marilyn had doled out some sharp words to her that day. Pat Newcomb left Marilyn's house somewhere between 5:30 and 6 p.m. Dr. Greenson departed around 7 p.m. due to his commitment to an already scheduled dinner date. Later, in confidence, Dr. Greenson would disclose to members of the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Team the reasons behind his patient's distress on her final day. According to Dr. Greenson, Marilyn had received a series of distressing phone calls that morning, leaving her in a state of anger and despair. She had recently engaged in sexual relationships with individuals of extraordinary influence within the government, individuals positioned at the highest tiers of power. When he encountered her that fateful afternoon, she expressed profound dissatisfaction, lamenting the paradox of being the world's most beautiful woman, yet lacking a date for a Saturday night. Dr. Greenson revealed that Marilyn had anticipated a meeting with one of these very important people that evening, only to be devastated upon learning that the rendezvous had been canceled. At 7:15 p.m. on August 4th, 1962, Marilyn received a call from Joe DiMaggio's son, Joe DiMaggio Jr. During their conversation, Joe told Marilyn that he had decided to end his engagement to his fiancée. Despite being divorced from Joe DiMaggio, Marilyn and Joe Jr. had maintained a strong and supportive friendship after the divorce. Upon hearing this positive update from Joe Jr., Marilyn's voice resonated with a sense of optimism and contentment, reflecting her genuine happiness for him. Marilyn had never really cared for Joe Jr.'s fiance. Her elevated mood was confirmed by Dr. Greenson, who she immediately called to tell him about Joe Jr.'s broken engagement. According to Dr. Greenson, Marilyn sounded normal during this phone call. However, less than 15 minutes later, at about 7:45 p.m., Peter Lawford called Marilyn to invite her to a party he was having, but he stated that Marilyn sounded heavily drugged. He claimed that he shouted her name into the phone a few times after she did not respond to him on the line. Donald Spotto wrote that Peter said Marilyn was saying, "Say goodbye to Pat, say goodbye to the president, and say goodbye to yourself, because you're a nice guy." We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows.
Today's episode of The Secret Sits was researched and written by the host, John Dodson. All episodes are engineered and mixed by me, Gabriel Dodson. Check the show notes for links to all of our social media. Email us at thesecretsitspodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.